This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As global oil becomes more expensive and then runs out, major urban centers need to figure out their local food supplies. We find a solution in Brooklyn, New York. Anastasia Cole Plakius is the vice president and founding partner of Brooklyn Grange Rooftop Farm. Anastasia, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for doing the show, Alex.
When and how did your project get going?
We started planning our flagship farm in the fall of 2009. We being a group of individuals, like-minded folks who really wanted to create a fiscally sustainable model for urban agriculture in, you know, cities that were more and more densely populated, where ground level space was less and less available.
And it looks like there are four major operations. Why don't we take them one at a time? Could you please describe the Brooklyn Navy Yard Farm?
Yeah, the Brooklyn Navy Yard Farm is our second farm. It is a 65,000 square foot rooftop farm in, of course, the Brooklyn Navy Yard. That being a very important partnership, of course, because the Navy Yard is an incredible beacon for sustainability here in New York City. It is a manufacturing hub, but very, very focused on green manufacturing. So when we were in touch with them a couple of years ago about possibly working together to build a rooftop farm on one of their buildings in their 300 acres of property, we decided to apply together for a grant from New York City, which was offering grants in stormwater management. Green roofs are an incredibly beneficial piece of infrastructure for cities with rapidly aging infrastructure. And stormwater management happens to be a huge challenge here in New York City, which has a combined sewer system. So the Brooklyn Navy Yard was funded in part by a grant from New York City, a green infrastructure grant in stormwater management, because our farms manage roughly 1 million gallons of stormwater a year.
So I expected to find container gardening on these roofs, but a video on your website seems to show a virtual dirt field right on top of the building. Why not container gardens?
Well, when you are leasing space by the square foot, when you have as limited space as we do on our rooftops are 43,000 square feet and 65,000 square feet, respectively, so about an acre and an acre and a half. You really don't want to lose even a centimeter to containers. They can also really add weight, but more than anything, you know, we really wanted to create an ecosystem that functions as naturally as possible. And the microbial life of that soil is something that we are constantly working towards supporting and, you know, and in an effort to get to a place where it supports itself.
How do you know these gardens won't cause damage to the building or even collapse the roof?
Oh, we always, always engage a structural engineer and or an architect to certify that the building is strong enough to support the weight of the farm. We typically look at huge industrial buildings. Most of them are pre-war, and we're typically talking about a solid concrete slab roof. But our buildings are absolutely certified to support far in excess of the weight that we are placing up there. And we are looking at the saturated weight of the soil, of course.
Well, sure, people park cars on roofs. Surely we could get some gardening going on up there. So, Anastasia, just to give our listeners the picture, how much produce can you get from your rooftop farm operations?
Yeah, it's an interesting metric and one that I struggle with. It's about 20,000 pounds of produce, but, of course, that's not anyone who grows themselves can say, and it's not a very telling metric because, of course, 20,000 pounds of tomatoes is very different than 20,000 pounds of salad greens, which is the bulk of what we produce. We find that cut green leaves grow incredibly well in our soil. They're incredibly flavorful. And, of course, they are a short shelf life crop. So we can really offer great value to the community by offering up this product that, you know, when it's being shipped from long distances, really suffers in quality. Ours, of course, is typically harvested mere hours before it's brought to market or delivered to the retail store or restaurant. So, you know, we really are able to deliver a very high-quality salad green. We grow a lot of arugula and, of course, a full diet of roots, fruits, flowers, you know, stems, all different shapes, colors, and nutrient values, because we do want to be able to offer this full diet, not just to our customers, but to ourselves and our families. We really have focused more and more on what we do well as the farm matures.
Yeah, I could see restaurants really coveting that fresh produce. It'd be great for their tables.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're actually finding more and more that we're being asked to come and build these farms for restaurants so that the chefs have their own fields in which to develop and grow crops for their own kitchens. Not many restaurants have, 65,000 square feet of rooftop, but you'd be amazed what you can do. Well, I have a feeling you wouldn't, Alex. I think you probably have a pretty good idea. But for those who are listening who aren't growers, you really would be amazed at what you can do in just a small amount of space.
And I expect you have a mother farm somewhere to provide plants and so on. Is that the purpose of that flagship farm on Long Island?
No, that farm is actually in Long Island City, which is in Queens, and it is a hop, skip, and a jump away from Midtown Manhattan. And that is just like the Navy Yard farm, it's a rooftop that's planted parapet wall to parapet wall, covered in soil, and we do actually start a number of our seedlings in a greenhouse. We have a big, beautiful greenhouse at the Brooklyn Navy Yard that is just packed to the brim right now with seedlings. But of course, a lot of those greens that I mentioned are direct sown crops. So we actually use the Johnny's cedar, just a push cedar. We're a real woman and man powered farm. Everything's done by hand up on the farm. So, we do definitely start a lot of our seeds in the greenhouse, which is what's happening now, and then transplant them out into the field. But a good number of our crops are direct sown.
Is this organic growing?
Yeah, we never use any chemical fertilizers or pesticides. Again, I can't stress enough how much we really rely on this produce to keep ourselves healthy and well. And we do feed this produce to our families. And of course, New York City is our city. It's our home. And it's one that we strive to make a greener and healthier place. So we would never want to contribute chemicals to that ecosystem or to our own bodies or to the bodies of the people who support us every day by buying our vegetables. So we actually do enjoy a fairly rigorous compost program at the farm. It's a really wonderful way to reduce some of the organic waste that we are pumping into the waste stream here in New York City. We're just starting to pilot some municipal compost programs here in New York City. But for the most part, we really don't have a whole lot of composting options because there are so many challenges to composting, of course, in urban areas. A big one being, of course, pests. And that really turns a lot of people off from composting. So not only do we recover as much as we can of the I think it's about 18% of what we throw away in New York City are organic food scraps that could be repurposed as nutrients for our soil. We do recover as much of that as possible, but we also really aim to teach and help develop compost programs in people's homes, offices, and just, show everyone that with a simple worm bin, you can really, really compost a lot of food scraps without creating a mess or a smelly pile that attracts pests. So we're actually about to launch our workshop schedule for the season, and we're very excited to be offering some compost workshops at the farm.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock as we find solutions for cities to raise more of their own local food. Our guest is Anastasia Cole Plakis from Brooklyn Grange, where they farm rooftops in New York City. In another special operation, Anastasia, you also have beehives. Tell us about the Brooklyn Grange Bees Apiary.
Yeah, bees are just such incredible creatures, and one that I think we're really going to be hearing a lot about in the years to come. Of course, nobody's quite sure what's causing colony collapse disorder, the huge challenge facing beekeepers and bees today. But bees are disappearing in alarming numbers, and there's some speculation that seems more and more likely that it's a combination of factors, pesticide use, and other agricultural conditions that is causing, these bees to suffer. So I think, everybody's going to continue to see bees coming up in the news. in the coming years. But the bottom line is we can't have food without our pollinating friends. And bees are just the best pollinators on the farm. And one of the things that's just so wonderful about keeping bees in the city is that you really don't face a whole lot of agricultural pesticide use in the cities. So our bees tend to be incredibly happy and healthy and prolific. The amount of honey they produce is just amazing. And it's really tasty. You know, you'll find that New York City honey all has a shared quality. The spring honey in particular has a pronounced mentholated quality, a minty note, almost like a eucalyptus. And that's actually the linden trees here in New York City. We have a great many linden trees. And the linden honey is, it's unmistakable. If you've had it before, you can recognize it anywhere. You know, we really think that beekeeping is just such a great, it's really a gateway activity. And so many of the youth who visit our farm come to the farm with these preconceived notions, you know, namely that worms are disgusting and soil is dirty, that it's dirt that you have to wash off your hands. And of course, bees are absolutely terrifying. This is something I can really relate to as I did grow up here in New York City. And as a kid, I was quite scared of bees. But, you know, most of the kids who visit the farm, they leave having completely changed their minds and really believe when they leave the farm and head back to their classrooms or their homes, they leave with this renewed interest and this belief that bees are worthy of protection. And that's work that we cannot directly take credit for. We actually partner with a nonprofit organization called City Growers. And City Growers has hosted to date over 10,000 youth at our two locations for educational explorations and workshops and visits to the farm. So we're incredibly fortunate to have such amazing and dedicated partners doing such incredible work to open up the minds of urban youth and get them thinking about how they can reinvent their own cities.
You brought up so many great points there. I just want to interject one thing. People may wonder if honey contains pollution from the city, and I can tell you, my friend at the University of Exeter, toxicologist Paul Johnson, tested honey from hives on a rooftop in downtown London. He found the honey was completely free of harmful chemicals. The bees purify their honey no matter what the pollution, and I think that's just another amazing thing about them. So if some of our listeners want to get a taste of New York City honey, can they do that?
Absolutely, yeah. We have two farm stands every week on the weekends. On Saturdays, we actually have an open house right up on our Long Island City farm location. So you can just head on up with the family. City Growers team is up there with some free, fun, farmy activities for the whole family to enjoy. We'll be selling produce, our own hot sauce made with our own peppers and herbs, and, of course, our rooftop honey. And then it's a great opportunity to enjoy the green space. And whether that's, you know, whether you want to jump in and get your hands dirty and help us turn some compost, or whether you prefer to just kick back and enjoy, you know, a rare bit of greenery in this concrete jungle of ours, there's really something for everyone to do. So we strongly encourage everybody. We're going to start the open houses up again in mid-May. All that information is on our website, brooklyngrangefarm.com.
And how long is your growing season in Brooklyn?
You know, it's been a heck of a late winter this year, Alex, and I think we're all getting a little bit squirrely. We really want to see that germination rate pick up a little bit just because we've had some really, really cold nights. And up until last week, I want to say, it was just, there's just so much cloud cover. Typically, we grow April through October, and recently with the later winters, we've been pulling carrots out of the ground as late as the week up until the holidays. So we really do have a little bit of a longer growing season, and, you know, that's in part because cities just tend to be a bit warmer due to urban heat island effect, you know, all that heat that gets trapped here in cities. I'm so glad that you raised the point about pollution and honey. It's a question that I get often, and when I don't get it, I wonder if people are just being polite. You know, is that food safe to eat grown in cities where there's so much pollution? And actually, we've engaged in an air quality study with Cornell University, and we're just amazed to see just how pure that air is up on the roof, because so much of the pollution that we deal with here in cities is particulate matter that's heavier than air. So we are really protected being up as high as we are And we definitely urge backyard gardeners to get their soil tested before planting in it. But if you can't plant edibles, it doesn't mean you can't plant something. So plant some flowers for those bees. Grow whatever you can, wherever you're growing it. There's always something that you can grow.
Now, Anastasia, as you know, until the recent opening of some farmers markets, there has been a shortage of fresh produce in African American and other ethnic neighborhoods. Do you see that your program could help with that, or an expansion of it could help with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the future of urban farming, we're really looking at a number of different methods and modes of producing food in cities. And I think that right now we're still in a very exploratory period. And I don't want to look at this too much through rose-colored glasses. There is a limit to what cities can produce, and we will never be entirely self-sufficient. We will always, always rely on our rural counterparts, the folks who've taught us so much of what we know about farming and to whom we owe a tremendous debt of gratitude. So, you know, we really should always remember that, particularly for meat, dairy, grain, and you know, and feeding a growing population, I don't want everybody to think that we'll be able to do that just on the rooftops of cities alone. But we can really grow a lot more than what we are right now, and we can get people involved and feeling like they are a bit more autonomous, a bit more that they have some agency in the way they are feeding themselves. And I think that's so important. A lot of the food deserts in New York City really contribute to a lot of the health crises that we face, the diabetes crisis. And I think a lot of it is that it can be a bit exhausting to have to think so much every time you are hungry. Sometimes it's easier to just reach for the nearest food. So often that means fast food. It means packaged food. It might, here in the city, mean a bodega that's just stocked with chips and candy. So the more fresh produce that we can bring into underserved areas of the city, the better. Again, you know, it might not be a large-scale commercial rooftop farm that works for your space, but school gardens are popping up everywhere, and it's just wonderful to see. So we really hope to see different methods, hydroponics, aquaponics, cropping up in cities around the world in the future.
I think Havana, Cuba is kind of a model for that. When they got cut off from their oil supply, they did manage to feed a large part of the city from gardens in and around the city itself. Now, you do your own radio show on the Internet Heritage Radio Network. What do you cover in Anastasia's Fridge?
Oh, Anastasia's Fridge is a really fun collaboration with our friends over at Heritage. And you know, Heritage Radio and Heritage Foods, which is a wonderful company, they're really incredible partners here in New York City's food world and really all around the country, just in terms of providing a voice for farmers, activists, you know, and really pushing everybody to connect. I, in particular, am grateful to them for an opportunity to just really geek out about vegetables. I happen to be a home cook myself, and there's nothing I love cooking more than vegetables. So Anastasia's Fridge is just a quick little review of what's fresh right now, maybe a little bit of its history or cultural significance, and then a recipe for people to try at home with that ingredient.
Are you in contact with other urban farms in other cities? Is there a conversation place or a site for that?
You know, there's definitely a couple organizations doing really wonderful work. The National Young Farmers Coalition is really just an amazing, amazing resource for folks who are just getting into farming, especially as we lose the traditional cultural trajectory of the family farm, you know, knowledge passed down through generations. I think that they will continue to be a really important resource. And, of course, the Greenhorns as well are really focusing their energies on young folks who are new to farming. Our friends at Stone Barns have a really wonderful site right now called the Virtual Grange, and I think that's a pretty fantastic way for farmers to get some information. But for the most part, you know, farming in a digital age is a beautiful thing, and I can't tell you how many times a day we pick up our phones, our cell phones out in the field, and phone a friend and ask, you know, about a disease symptom that we're seeing on a plant or their best strategy about battling a certain pest. And then, of course, the Internet, just having access to Google. Actually, Google satellite images are how we found our sites for our farms. So we really can't underestimate just how fortunate we are to be farming in this day and age. And then, of course, just the network on on Twitter and Facebook and all the social media sites. It really allows people to be generous in sharing information, and that is so much what we need to focus on in the coming years. All farmers have a responsibility to also be teachers and really help that flow of information increase in power and really gain momentum.
Well, that's a good place to wrap it up. I could talk to you for an hour, and maybe someday we'll do that. I'll put a bunch of those links in my show blog at ecoshock.info. And could you just, as we finish up, give us again your website and your Facebook page for the Brooklyn Grange Project?
Yes, it's brooklyngrangefarm.com. We can be found at facebook.com/brooklyngrange. We're also on Twitter and Instagram. If you, for those of you who have desk jobs and you want to follow along from work.
Great. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest has been Anastasia Kolplakius, the vice president and a founding partner of Brooklyn Grange Rooftop Farm in fabulous New York City. Thank you so much, Anastasia.
Alex, thank you so much. Will you come visit us next time you're in town?
I would like to do that, and I want to get a taste of that honey.
Oh, yeah, for sure. We'll definitely make it happen. Thanks so much for having me, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.